maybe I'll start. It seems to me one of the central questions you're struggling with, you raised at the end, is how much should it cost? But in a sense, it seems to me that that's not really what you're asking. Mm-hmm. That the central question you're asking is more about who is financially benefiting and how through this original work and then how it's being reproduced. So then in some ways, it's not really about how much should it cost, but who's in whose material interests or who is benefiting financially from the digital reproduction and circulation of it.
Right.
And that in ways leads us to then a different set of issues and questions than your initial question, which doesn't seem to be your core question, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the core question keeps me wandering, but I'm done with this. but I think that's really important because the moral remit for doing this among Tumblr users is I can't afford $150, and I can't afford $30. In fact, I can't afford $5, right? I can't afford to buy this book at any price. And so this is why I think people are sharing it and not feeling badly about theoretically taking money from other women of color, because it was out of print for a long time, and so it was not affordable. But also, there's a kind of exceptionalism around this book too. This were something like The Help, right? Or the latest Harry Potter, then there would be a question about that. Like, those books were written to make money. But this book, in every page, it says it's not, right? That it's written for a different reason. I want to throw in there that there's a backlash against this idea that some things should be free. You know, and especially women of color have a history of often being exploited and not getting paid. So we're still trying to work out how to explain that, because when I'm giving this talk, mostly celebrating the kind of wonderful initiative and curatorial expertise of anonymous people, which is kind of what Wikipedia is about too, then it kind of risks ignoring the fact that there are people who would potentially be making money off of this book otherwise.
I just mentioned I just read the addition to the fourth, by Shiri Maraga. Mm-hmm. So, you know, beautifully poetically written, and so moving and so depressing, I gotta say. Because she begins just by saying, well, what's happened to 35 years since this book was published? She goes through the United States war in Iraq, what they did to the Sandinistas, torture chambers set up. And she really talks about the radicalization of politics itself. And it's extreme results for intensified issues having to do with gender and racism and things like this. So, I had a question about the two companies. So, could you just reflect on the actual politics of the book itself? Because this is written really, on a color, really to speak about the possibility of radical politics. Most of her introduction saying, and there are possibilities, really, it's just at this pretty grisly political situation, which is now global.
Yeah, I taught the book, but I hadn't read it in a while, so I started reading it again, and it strikes me that there is such a strong emphasis on queer politics in it, that it was not just reacting against white feminism, but straight feminism, particularly. And so it was trying to do really intersectional work, and I think we take that for granted now, that feminism is intersectional. But I was impressed by how carefully those issues were kind of grappled with, and how unusual it is to have, more than one work by a First Nations or Indigenous person. So that was also something that was in that book, which I had forgotten about, but it was very much there. So there's a lot of kind of political economic critique in there about women's work and the kind of these, working four jobs and taking the bus and trying to write poetry on the side. And I think that was very much about the 80s, like the recession that people were experiencing. But I think people are doing that now. So the politics around transnational, U.S. empire and misbehavior were right front and center in that book too. And I think that's another reason why the book is popular again, right? Is because that is still the case. And Hart and Negri's work especially, I think, has made U.S. Empire interesting again to people. So this book seems to be doing, really ahead of its time, what a lot of postmodern European thinkers were just starting to do like 10 years ago. And that's also fun to read. You know, reading Hart and Negri is like running into a wall. I mean, you can do it. And they, interestingly, have a very pro-informatic approach to the multitude, that the multitude is Tumblr, right? The multitude is everyone who is not part of the kind of 1% is going to do something great and rise up. And that's not clear. But I think that was what this Bridge Called My Back was literally doing. Like, it rejected all the people who were credentialed experts. It just didn't want to reduplicate that privileged. And so this is why it was hard to reprint, weirdly, is that they purposely took voices who otherwise would not be heard. Right. So they could have had Adrienne Rich write the foreword. She was willing to contribute. She was involved with the project. But they were reacting partly against her. So she had great politics. I think they got along. But they said, there's enough Adrienne Rich in the world as it is. Like, we don't need more of that. She'll find a way to get published anyway. So I think the politics is partly about like understanding the U.S.'s role as a truly evil corporation in many ways, but it was also about understanding publishing's role as a truly evil corporation that tends to let the same voices get heard over and over again, right? So their foreword was by Toni Cade Bambara, who was kind of a superstar. She had written one book, I think, The Salt Eaters, and she got much more famous later. They knew they had to have a marquee writer to get people to buy it because no one had heard of Cherry Moraga or Anzaldúa, but they wanted a woman's book. And so they decided they would go that way, even if it made the book less appealing on the shelf. It didn't seem to hurt it. So that's a roundabout answer to your question, but yeah.
I guess two things quickly. You mentioned at the start of how the artifact itself seemed to be a very significant thing. And then later on, it strikes me that the publishers don't have an electronic version for sale.
Yeah.
And is it because the artifact itself is so significant that an electronic version is seen as somehow diminishing? Like, there is no market for it?
Oh, no. I think it's copyright. So you can't publish it if it's out of print in any form.
Right.
Right, because they had no agreement with the contributors to republish it. So that, you know, they couldn't do it digitally for dumb reasons.
Right. But now that, I mean, clearly the publishers now publish a print for our vote to publish a print version.
Uh-huh.
So presumably have copyright, the permissions are square for that. So is it they didn't get the rights to move it into a different medium? Is that essentially the problem?
Yeah, so when it was out of print, yeah, they couldn't put it in print in digital form either. So Sumi doesn't have a digital version, but I think Amazon will. I think Amazon does that. So they make it Kindle friendly and the publishers have to deal with it. It'll probably be $9. But you know, that's an interesting question. Who's gonna wanna buy the Kindle version when you can get this, I would say, a more interesting version for free that is truly collaborative in a way that paper books can't be. So, you know, in digital media, we like to say that the digital is a moving artifact and you're never in the same stream twice, and that's why it's so great. And so the kind of toppling of the hierarchy of who's the writer, who's the publisher, you can see very literally in the digital version, right, where this Bridge was originally supposed to be about amateurs for amateurs. And here are some anonymous amateurs who decided they're going to make this book. You know, they're going to put it up. If it gets taken down, they're going to put it back up. They're going to rearrange it. They're going to add new things. And they just did it. So in some ways, it's very like the first version, which was that way, only, you know, if it's licensed culturally, it's under very different logic. So Tumblr is a promiscuous medium. You find all kinds of stuff on there. But interestingly, Tumblr doesn't host PDFs. You can put pictures, you can put video, and they purposely don't have PDFs because they want it to be a visual medium and look more like a magazine. And it would be so easy to let PDFs be there. But what that also means is that they're not responsible for the PDFs that people link to because they're not hosting them. So all the free books on Tumblr, not Tumblr's problem. maybe kind of a smart thing to do.
Can I follow up on this?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the thing that really amazed me about your talk was that it started off, you started off talking about issues of feminism, but that ended up being about platforms,
mm-hmm.
really, and that really interested me. And you outlined this way in which the book, in terms of content, but also the way it was produced, tried to embed these certain values into its production. Does the digital book have that future? I feel like you almost seem to suggest that ebooks can't do that anymore, that we need a new medium, it needs to be something like that. Do you think there is a feminist future for the electronic book? Or is that just totally tied to production networks that are antithetical to those types of values?
That is a great question. I think it depends on how we define book and author, right? Because is that PDF a book? It doesn't have an author who will claim this foreword, right? So I think that definitely Tumblr is a feminist platform, but only because feminists have made it one. So there's nothing in particular about the platform, I think, which was made for women. In fact, I think people are surprised that it became a woman's space. Pinterest was always meant for women, right? I think it was marketed to women. It was specifically for women to do things like shop and to do interior design. But Tumblr was just meant to be something like Twitter. It was a microblogging platform. Anybody could use it. It was free. And so the appropriation of that space by feminists has been unexpected. So I don't think that feminist platforming has got to do with the intentions of the developer, but they become spaces that way. And what's fascinating to me is how feminist users have purposed the medium for that, right? But I think that you could take any platform, and if you had the will, make it that way. Yeah.
So communities.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, you know, we like to say that communities are emergent forces in co-creation, but that's often bullshit. Because you've seen how communities try to take things like Facebook, like the breastfeeding mothers community in Facebook, totally crushed by Facebook, you know, because it was viewed as porn and inoffensive, and so Facebook was like, no, they kind of smashed it. And the women kept on trying to do it more, and then kept on getting banned, and finally people, I think, kind of gave up. But Tumblr wouldn't do that, because I've seen those pictures on Tumblr, right? So Tumblr has a different profit kind of agenda. They're bought by Yahoo. They have ads, but they're cool ads. Like, they're ads like for Denny's, and, you know, they have a different sensibility because they know that people won't have it on Tumblr, right? They just mock it continually until people just got rid of it, I think. But that's a really, really key question. I think we talk about the values embedded in production. So maybe not the production of the platform, but the production on the platform. Yeah.
I think it's important to note, as a user of Tumblr, that Tumblr does in fact participate in some type of censorship, and I've seen it a lot myself surrounding the rise in black politics currently in the United States, surrounding all the police brutality and police violence,
mm-hmm.
and also in the recent death of Lila Alcorn, who was the young trans girl, and Tumblr has completely shut down any tags related to her name, and people bring it back, but you see a really big but also sort of subversive backlash from Tumblr in hiding these tags, hiding these links,
mm-hmm.
taking down her blog, taking down her, pardon me?
Oh, her mom requested it.
Yeah, and a lot of censorship around the tags surrounding Black Lives Matter and all of these things. So I think it's just important to acknowledge that Tumblr is definitely not without its own bias, and whoever is behind all of this is definitely not without its own agenda in that way. You see a lot of very, like, homogenous, very heteronormative, very white-centered things being privileged on Tumblr, and a lot of counterculture, a lot of culture for people of color being kind of swept under the rug. as well. So that's definitely, there is that. It's kind of this weird contradiction in that it's such a space for people to share and find their community and to connect and to have that open avenue and that open platform. But then there's also this kind of like sneaking Big Brother is watching type element to it as well. And I think it's a shame. We're never quite free from that. And you see that with these instances. There's probably tons more. Those are just the only two that come to mind right now.
So where are those communities going? Their hashtags are being hidden. Like, where are they putting them on Twitter? Where do they go?
From what I've seen, people are bringing them back. I see, because I think Tumblr users are especially, like, they cover their tracks, and people on Tumblr are very smart. And this isn't new to a lot of people who've had, I've only had a blog for maybe 3 years. People have been on there since its inception, and there are people who have been through this kind of thing before. So they have a backup plan, and I've seen a lot of people saved things from Leela's blog. They saved her suicide note. People are saving her artwork, all these things to bring it back and to keep that alive. So it's definitely not going away. It's definitely not being, I don't think Tumblr, unless they're going to start shutting down blogs and really taking this like definitive censorship stance, which would blow up in their faces, they're not going to go that far, I don't think. So people do have that ability to bring things back when they have been taken down. And there's a lot of, you can send emails to the staff and that kind of stuff. I don't know how much they listen. Like, for example, they were asking recently for Black History Month to have a Tumblr banner on the front page, as they have done for so many other things and things that are pretty benign. What's that?
Pi Day.
But they wouldn't have a Black History Month banner, even for a day. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. It's a deeply political space, and people are asking them to step up and, you know, to be accountable for the things that they're doing, for sure.
Yeah, no, it was interesting, because one of the things that you're talking about was they cleared the Ferguson tag. It wasn't that the posts were taken down, but if you search the tag, the queue was empty.
And that's how people find
and
stuff,
so
right?
You can find anybody else's tag. Work.
Wow.
Yeah, and there was a big thing about when, so, I don't know if people are familiar with doxing.
Yes.
There was a big thing where, like, literal members of the KKK were being doxed, and Tumblr just jumped on that, like, right away, yet was very reticent to address issues of an actual, like, neo-Nazi sub-community within Tumblr. And there was actually a situation, there was somebody who had a, what was it? There was something in the news recently about somebody who went out and shot somebody or something, and he had a Tumblr, and it was all just some very intense neo-Nazi, very Columbine obsessed kind of thing. So it's just kind of interesting to see that within something, because Tumblr is seen as this kind of paragon of social justice warriors or whatever. So it's interesting to see how that kind of works within that. And also going back to, I'm getting a little off track, but the point I was saying about Tumblr being this fortress of SJW, it's interesting to see communities from Reddit or 4chan who kind of see it as this penetrable thing. There was a thing on 4chan a while ago where their aim was to take down Tumblr. My stepfather is really into Reddit and was familiar with the term Tumblrinas, which is a fun way that misogynists talk about people on Tumblr. So it's interesting to me that in a lot of ways how there's people who are like, I'm gonna overthrow feminism or this or that by this kind of way, it's kind of moved into I'm going to get into Tumblr and off-throw Tumblr and, oh, you're not really doing anything, you're just doing this online, coming from other online communities. And just kind of the very kind of almost gendered dichotomy between Reddit and Tumblr is very interesting. Even in the way that like fandom is processed, there's like a curative versus transformative fandom. How in Reddit, a lot of it is concerned with the canon and what actually is this and what is that. It's a kind of masculinized way of looking at it, whereas Tumblr fandom is very kind of based.
It's all made up.
It's mostly fan. It's about, like, the, again, going back to the emotional aspect of it, it's about taking the fantasy of it and applying it to yourself rather than regulating and defining what it is. So I just thought that was interesting for Tumblr to be this thing that folks have to oppose or be part of in this kind of fortressy kind of way.
Right, yeah, only on Tumblr is Teen Wolf the greatest TV show ever. But yeah, the reason I wanted to write about this is that I'm working with someone who's 20 years younger than me, right? Because he really understands the Tumblr world. And people who say that fake feminists are encouraged and engendered by platforms like Tumblr have to shut up when they see this bridge called My Back as a tag that's like popular and trending, because this bridge called My Back is like definitely a genuine radical feminist text. And so this idea that young feminists don't know the history, they don't care about real scholarship, you're in it for the fashion, you know, they're not really serious. This bridge called My Back is as serious as death. Like, that is the most serious book ever written. And so I was very taken by that as a kind of counter-argument to the notion that social media feminism is superficial, right? Because this is like the least superficial book ever written. And it also has this interesting history of appropriation. So when you were talking about women saving the blog posts and the photos and the artifacts from this downed blog, I thought, you know, this ethics of recovery or preservation is such a feminist ethic. You know, especially around early women's writing. So Virago Press, like there's all these feminist presses, and they had to exist for a reason, which is that men sometimes don't want to read women's writing. You know, that's just a fact. And so there are feminist presses like Virginia Woolf's time, and like well before that, because women really can't trust, you know, like for-profit male presses to publish the work. So I thought, well, like this is a good argument that there's a serious, real feminism going on.
The idea of recovery I thought was interesting, because a lot of posts will be like master posts on all these things you need to read, and this is your history, know this, and it's kind of just like Angela Davis, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, and a lot of them are kind of themed around don't forget where you come from, this is this, this is that, and really reaching out to folks, and a lot of younger people are like, I never heard of these people, and kind of where, specifically from my approach, like queer liberation came from, and this and that, and a lot of memorial tags, and listing people's names, and it's a very interesting kind of historical reclamation that goes on, I think.
Yeah, and most of these women are not in school. From what I can tell, that's what's interesting about it, is that you could expect that if you took women's studies and you're like, I'm on fire for this, and then, you know, 2 years later I'm in my job and whatever. These are not students. So I think that is very cool, right? That's the radical possibility.
I think this is where it gets interesting, because for me, Tumblr is transformative and is such a resource, because I have the privilege to be in university, and I have the privilege to read a lot of texts that are not otherwise available. I have access to theory, to theoretical discussions, but that is not the crux of feminism, and I don't think that it should be. And I think that's where we've seen in first and second wave, and even third wave feminism, the exclusionary aspect of that and of social justice groups, is that I have had conversations with people who are like, oh, well, you don't know this and this and this author and this theorist, then you don't know what you're talking about. And it's like, that's, you're missing the entire point. And I get really bothered by that. And as people get, in response, I get very upset about Tumblr, because A, they don't think education or access to information should be free. They're bothered by this sort of queering of the capitalist, you know, imperialist agenda. And so they get really upset about Tumblr, because that's what it's all about. It's free access to everything. It's collaborative. It's, if you know something you want to share, your life story and your personal experience is just as valid as this textbook that's going to tell us what, you know, we're supposed to know. And that's what I love about it. And I also see the struggle in, especially with this book in particular, like, I know that Christos, you know, was cleaning houses to pay the bills and was not being published and was not making money, and I want I want her to be able to live and be so financially stable and to be recognized for her work. But do I think that it should also be a mechanism of this, you know, capitalist machine? No, I don't think that it's okay that information is only available to people who can pay for it. I think that's where we have to walk that very fine line of giving artists the dues that they are deserved, that they are owed, and not just privileging white straight voices, of course. And I think that's why this book was so transformative and so huge. But I think it's hard when the book that it was written by and the book that it was, the people it was written by, the people it was written for, are the people who could not have afforded to buy it. Like, Christos probably wouldn't be able to afford to buy her own book for $120.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that alone is just like mind-boggling. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, and to say that they were before their time, I don't even think they were. They were before white people's time, sure. But, you know, for people of color, for women of color in queer communities, this kind of stuff has always been their time.
Right.
This has
right.
been, you know, the crux of everything since,
yeah.
you know.
I'm
yeah.
also concerned about a certain kind of romanticization. You called it exceptionalism
yeah.
of Tumblr.
And of this bridge.
Yeah,
yeah
I love that text, too. Some of these students are my students in taken in three iterations now, we've produced transnational feminist blogs
oh.
as a class project.
Yeah.
Each time, students have been free to choose whatever platform they want to. None of them have chosen Tumblr. I mean,
we talked about it.
You did it the last time. We chose WordPress or blogs.
WordPress.
Yeah. So it's going on everywhere, and I don't know. There's some exoticization going on around Tumblr. I think that needs to be undermined too, to destabilize it.
Yeah, I know WordPress is an interesting platform because it's a good way to hide things, right? Because there's no like automatic. If you put something on WordPress, no one's gonna see it unless you try. It's default private because it's obscure and it's not gonna show up in a Google search. But Tumblr is public. And so I can see somebody who has emergent ideas or doesn't want to be involved in a big conversation about the stuff, not wanting to put it there. And some people already have Tumblr identities. And maybe they don't want to like mix those two things together, right? Because in some ways, bringing school into like, the social space can be a kind of weird thing for people.
Well, it's deliberately subversive because students, one of the students, knowledge producers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of subverting the knowledge containment, the institution containment that this university imposes on the free circulation of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. You're giving it away whether you're putting it on Tumblr or on WordPress for sure. Right, it's free. I think it's not publicized or surfaced the same way on WordPress. So maybe that's why people are doing it. I have my students do a blog, and many of my students are transnational feminists, and I always tell them I will delete the whole blog after class, and all of a sudden it's a private, so you better keep your stuff,
right?
Unless you want me to make it public, and the students have always wanted for it to be private, and they've always wanted me to delete it all. And this is partly because of what I'm always telling them in the intro class, it's up there forever. You know, and they're starting to understand that and are very concerned about it. So there's a whole different ethos about sharing now, especially if you're queer, especially if you're trans, especially if you're a person of color, because those things make people more vulnerable, right? So my white men are like, sure, put it up, you know, fine.
You're a moving target. If you're any of those categories, you're a moving target.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Well, I guess, too, that, like, as somebody who also uses Tumblr and, like, writes about their own personal experience on Tumblr, it's, like, you face a lot of backlash for the things that you write. I've had, like, white nationalists find the things that
mm-hmm.
I've written and then proceed to reblog them and, like, with their own comments or, like, you know, you get anonymous messages, like, you should go die, kill yourself,
yeah.
sort of
right.
thing. So, the backlash is there, and I think part of why, because we have chosen Tumblr as a platform, like, in terms of doing blog projects with you, but Tumblr is, like, I think necessarily transformative because it's an interactive
mm-hmm.
platform too. Like the sociality of it is like much more there than it is with a platform like Blogger or WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it like Tumblr requires like a lot of maintenance and like a lot of like connections to maintain. And I guess too, yeah, like it makes you very vulnerable. Like I wouldn't start a blog where I like put my name right front and center.
Right.
Like, in fact, it looked like you would be hard pressed to find my name anywhere
mm-hmm.
on my Tumblr because that's not what it's necessarily like about. It is a form of self-publishing, but it's not a form of self-publishing where I feel I necessarily have to represent like myself with my given first name and given last name, and I am an academic and all of these things. I don't write as an academic, but I write
right.
on that blog.
Right, yeah, this is our dilemma in publishing this. We're gonna try to get it in PMLA, which is the most conservative English publication ever. And we're requesting permissions for images from Tumblr from the people who put them up. And,
good for you for requesting.
Yeah.
It sounds like good for you for requesting. Because also lots of people get their like images and art stolen on that website.
Right,
Yeah.
Which is not right.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
We've had friends who had their pictures like show up in ads in their sidebar for something else, and they'd be like, wait a minute, what?
When did we ever be like in an ad for this?
But exactly. It's usually for like taking that stuff as well.
Well, you know, that happens on every platform. Mm-hmm. Twitter does that to me all the time. If I ever eat any food, an ad will appear tweeting my tweet. But even if I hated the food.
Mm-hmm. I think if I may, anyone else did. I didn't know I'm taking a lot of space. One thing that was interesting in terms of like accessibility is not even the fact that it's on the internet and people can get at it, but there's a lot of conversation that's happening about the accessibility of language in terms of people's feminist posting and people having these like really intense flame wars about whether or not it should be a priority for academics to make their work accessible to folks who don't have that same kind of language. And it's kind of this whole conversation that's continually going, okay, yeah, we're making this reading available, we're making this available, but I don't know how many people have had trouble kind of trying to read Deleuze and Guattari and kind of sit there on their own and work through it without crying a little. Maybe that's me. Red Bull. But yeah, so it's just this kind of interesting thing about getting it out there, but also making sure once it's out there that you can even understand
exactly.
it, whether or not that should be a priority. And like a lot of artists who come out of Tumblr, like Leaf is this queer rapper who is like profiled as being like a Tumblr musician or Tumblr artist, and in terms of Mickey Blanco and artists like that, and about how is your theory and how is your academia relevant at all if the people it's about can't understand it. Like, what does that mean to people who are actually like doing sex work like in the streets if they don't understand what, like, if that doesn't mean anything to them? Like, what's the point? And that whole kind of conversation is something that happens a lot on Tumblr, and I think is really interesting, is kind of that kind of community discussion of what are our intentions more so than what are we talking about, like why and how are we talking about it.
Yeah, you could say women's studies is a bad advertisement for feminism in some cases. And people say, oh, I didn't realize that I was interested in feminism until I looked at Tumblr. Then I realized, absolutely. Barbara Christian writes about this in Making Soul, Making Face, when she talked about the race for theory. And she said, why is it that as soon as women of color show up in the academy, queer people show up in the academy, everything is in French? You know, now it's deconstruction. Like, why did that happen in the 80s? It's because, like, the universities got opened up. It was open access or open admission at CUNY. And now here are all these black, brown, and white faces who are women. Let's make it so that they can't participate. Right? So now we're teaching Toni Morrison, but the criticism is something no one can understand or can do. And I think she was totally right about that. So Gayatri Spivak writes about this too, right? Saying that sometimes legitimacy has this price and that you can do your kind of political practice in other ways, which she does. So she runs a woman, a girl's school in India. So that's her thing. Like, she's not trying to write easier books. She's at Columbia. How's that going to work? But she did start a school, and she flies back there, and it's to teach, you know, Indian girls writing and reading and, like, math stuff. So, you know, those two missions have always been what radical politics are about. But as you say, it's not easy to do both of those things at the same time, right? Being in the academy is important for us, but, you know, people still got to get their tenure, right? Like, you've got to not get fired so you can have your door open for your woman of color students. It's really important. So if she can't figure out how to do it, I don't think anybody can. She's probably the smartest person in the world. So.
Well, just in terms of it, because we're talking about how, you know, like women have completely reproduced this bridge called Layback and been able to host PDFs of books, or like when you see PDF, like these giant master lists of like, know your feminist history, know your woman of color feminist, know your womanist, often it will come with like blog links, or not other blog links, like links to PDFs that you can download,
yeah, like
or subscribe pages
of,
you know, these people's works. And I feel like part of doing that is part of feminists engaging in this act of like democratizing the knowledge that they like do now know or have or hold as a result of like being in the academy. Like I, you know, I feel like when I write on my blog, I try really hard not to use academic language, but sometimes it'll be based on ideas that obviously I've come to in school, and I feel like I don't have a problem with people sharing that work in that sense, because at least for myself, I know I've put it on there in order to be shared. So if people speak verbatim without like citing me, that's a different issue, but like if people want to reblog my post or like absorb that idea into their own feminism, I feel like that's part of the process of like engaging Tumblr in a feminist way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, I just see people, yeah, who decide to make PDFs of their books, or, you know, will download a journal article and then host it
mm-hmm.
somewhere so that other people, like that's how I came to find one of the most foundational scholars for my final work, was on Tumblr. Because I had found someone quoted part of a Lily Cho paper and then had the link to the entire paper. And I was like, oh my god, thank god.
Uh-huh.
And it changed my life.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it was a, like it's a way to kind of democratize this information and share it and like make it applicable on a person-to-person level, which I find like really interesting and super beautiful, because the Lily Cho article is actually quite dense, but the quote that was there was so relatable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was about memory and longing in the diaspora, the idea of also all sharing this like common experience of loss, even though we have, you know, we've lost from different contexts and histories and things like that. So it was really interesting to see the ways in which like that quote obviously floated around. Maybe tons of people didn't check out her article,
mm-hmm.
but even that quote resonates
yeah.
with, you know, 16,000 people, because that's how many notes the blog or the post
wow.
has.
Probably
totally, and like
right
these people might not even know who this woman is. And so I think it's really interesting as like a part of doing that. I guess within the specific context of this bridge called my back, like I don't know. I feel that it is in part carrying on like the work of bringing that book, this literature, to women who would not have otherwise had. I mean, I am a university student, and I know how expensive books are for me. Like, I would not hate myself for downloading a PDF of a book. I've done
mm-hmm.
it because I don't have the money to access
right.
all this literature. I just sold half my library to try and make rent over the summer,
right.
you know, to this school for dollars a book, $2
right.
a book, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, this is expensive feminist literature that I spent $80 buying. And you know, to me, even in doing that, I was like, okay, I'm getting a little bit back now, but at least somebody, somewhere down the line, at least pays the use price
mm-hmm.
for these books. Like, I've gotten my knowledge out of that, and for me, I'm like, still the internet, so maybe I can come back into contact with this information again. I guess for me, it's like, it's there's like an impermanence there to the
mm-hmm.
to the idea of having this information either in print or in digital form. Like, it, I don't know, it transmutes a lot, and I think that's really interesting. See that happen.
Yeah, you know, something I didn't talk about but I want to write a lot about is the way Audre Lorde has become such a citational keystone for so many Tumblr blogs, and it's partly because Tumblr is made for theory, right? It is so so common that you see a one or two sentence passage in Tumblr, someone will put it in their blog, and it gives you time to absorb it. If you try to read 200 pages of Audre Lorde, or really any of these people, your brains are going to be scrambled, right? It's not meant to be taken that way. Like, it is really meant to be kind of intense but small dosage aphorisms. So I always think of Nietzsche and Audre Lorde in a similar way. Like, they both are meant to be read in like a paragraph at a time, no more. And people complain, but it's not a narrative. It's not like, you know, there's no thesis. Like, well, shut up. Like, that's not what knowledge is about sometimes. So you can see, in some ways, theory is coming back because of the way that Tumblr is so good at like making magazine-like boxes
yeah.
and putting the knowledge in these very separate spaces so you can take each one and just kind of think about it, right? So it's a close reading technology. But again, I don't think it was made for that particularly. I think it was made for pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
outfits and cats and, you know, recipes
like,
and whatnot.
Most of them, which like, I guess like half of the time, like that is what Tumblr is,
yeah.
and then there's other people, and there's people who devote like the entirety of their blogs to writing these like huge pieces that you come across,
yes,
and there's people
true.
Who, you know, it's like 900 cats and then like some shit about gender. It's really interesting. Or I think what's also cool to see is the like pop culture crossover,
yeah,
of like, you know, the like memification of
Saved
of,
by the
of critical feminist
yeah.
theories.
Yeah.
I started
if
following
if
the
you
blog.
See Saved by the Bell Books.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Know that
yeah.
And so it's pictures. It's still from the movie or from the show Saved by the Bell, but with like these block quotes of like Bell Hooks quotes.
I think my students throw that back at me. Bell Hooks said that.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, that's great. Like, you know about Bell Hooks.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Well, and to make it like culturally applicable valuable and relevant still in these ways that like are recognizable to maybe the average person who spends a bunch of time on the internet recognizes a meme, but then it's like, oh, this is some like interesting complicated language. Like, who is bell hooks?
Well,
what do I, you know?
Yeah. From whoever.
Yeah, I think that's what important about it is that theory doesn't have to exist in a vacuum. It doesn't have to exist solely in academia. And like, I have seen dense theory explained to me on Tumblr in a way that made such sense to me and that I actually could get it and connect it to all these various things. And it's like, here, think about this that's happening here and these people talking about this. And I'm like, shit, this makes so much more sense than I ever could try and piece together or was ever pieced together for me in a classroom setting. And none of that doesn't happen in a lot of my classrooms, but university is pretty, you know, it can be very one-sided. And this is a way that, yeah, it's. I think it's, we shouldn't be assuming or talking about this in the way that Tumblr users who are not in university don't have that basis for understanding and don't have that, and you know, that creative thinking, that analytical ability, because they do, and often, I would say, in a better way, because they're coming at it from this very different kind of grassroots, kind of, you know, foundational, grounded approach that just, it breaks it down in a way that makes so much more sense, that is so not this airy, you know, bullshit that you hear so often. And it's this very much like, they're talking to you in a way that makes sense to you, and especially for our generation. I mean, people from many generations are on Tumblr, but from this sort of like, you know, large population, I would guess, on Tumblr are in their 20s. And that makes sense to them, and that's like, I can't access, you know, they can't go to the university and access those books, but but they can read Lord and know what she's talking about and talk about it and make sense of these things, and also that it's not restricted to white academia, it's open up to the people that Lord is actually talking about. It makes a lot more sense. And it's transnational, and I think that's what's really important as well, is that if you have access to the internet and if you're not in a country that is deeply censored, you can have Tumblr and you can read, like, I'm learning about feminist history that is not restricted to North American feminism. You know, I'm learning about feminists from India, from Bosnia, from everywhere. It's brilliant.
Yeah, you know, Mia McKenzie of Black Girl Dangerous has a lot more in common with Audre Lorde than she does with other feminist writers now, even though they're very far apart. And when she published her book, I thought, good for her, because the route to legitimacy is still paper publication. You know, and now people are teaching Black Girl Dangerous, even though they could get it for free.
Right.
Because professors need to have textbooks.
Yeah.
And if we don't have textbooks, then we're supposedly not doing our job.
She's actually cut a lot of stuff off of her blog. Like, there's links where you have to purchase your book now to get.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for some of the other stuff.
What do you think of that?
It was kind of, I think when I first found that, like, it was like only a few months ago I noticed. And I was kind of frustrated because I wanted to reread a piece that, like, I'd liked a long time ago. And yeah. But, I don't know. Yeah. But I also do support her work too, so, like, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Buttons and stuff on
the side
of their blog.
I don't know this, but where is Tumblr stored? Like, where are the servers?
It's owned by Yahoo, so I assume they're Yahoo servers somewhere.
Yeah, it's owned by Yahoo.
Yahoo is a Silicon Valley company, so I assume
maybe
Pacific Northwest or California.
But in the States.
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
would it make a difference, like, copyright-wise?
Well, and just long-term archiving, I think it would make a severe difference. Like, so I was thinking about, you know, hashtags disappearing.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're not disappearing from the servers. They're disappearing from the front side of
right. Access
side, right? So you could, if you wanted in 15, 20 years to look at these histories of Tumblr, where they're going to be in that,
right.
in that time period is an interesting question.
See, I think this would be a great digital, this would be a great DH dissertation.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of talk about Tumblr. There is almost no writing about Tumblr. Almost no academic writing about Tumblr, which isn't to say that it needs to be theorized from the outside. It's theorizing itself perfectly well, but it's not being archived, right? It's not being described in its kind of specificity to preserve it as it changes, because it's changing a lot. Like, as you say, things disappear frequently or rearrange or somehow black boxed from the people who make it and who use it. And so if a technologist were to get together with a woman studies scholar and try to write an actual accounting of how this works, Like, where do these things go? Like, how is censorship achieved? How could it be gotten back? Like, that would be really, really cool.